Okay, so start off, not neglect the obvious. Just start off by the kind of straightforward basics. I said them already, but I'll say it again. What are the Brahmaviharas? First of all, what does Brahmavihara mean? Because that might be helpful as well. Vihara means abode or dwelling place. You often hear it associated with the dwelling place of monks or nuns, but actually got a wider meaning, much wider meaning than that. So it means abode or dwelling place. And Brahma is a reference to one of the ancient Indian and now Hindu deities, who Brahma's the overall, the creator of the world. So Brahmavihara literally means the abode of Brahma. So you might wonder why that's got into Buddhism, since Brahma doesn't hold a place, or at least not that important a place in Buddhism. Certainly not the Buddhism that we practice in the West. Maybe a bit different in India. Basically, it's a way of indicating that the mind, the kind of mental states in the mind that we can create for ourselves, if we could dwell in the Brahmaviharas, would be a mind of great good fortune and almost a godlike mind. That's the association it has within an Indian context, but I don't know if that quite works for us. But it's just an indicate that if we could really let our minds be permeated by loving kindness and the others, then we wouldn't experience mental suffering or mental anguish. We would experience great joy all the time. We'd be in a very, very fortunate state. So the name indicates all of that in a particular way. But it's good for us to try and enter that world. I think if Brahma doesn't quite work, I think we could probably lay that aside. But Vihara is quite an evocative word to use in terms of abode and dwelling place and where your mind dwells, what your mind's surrounded by. So it's quite good just to bear that in mind. So the meditations, the Brahmavihara meditations then, are on loving kindness, compassion, gladness or sympathetic joy. I quite like gladness. It is often described as, especially in our movement, mudita's translated as sympathetic joy, but I came across another translation a few years ago that I just like gladness. I just like the simplicity of it. So gladness is the third one, and then equanimity, the fourth one. So it's a set of practices, or a mandala of meditation practice. There's a process of unfolding that happens when we practice them, and the practices themselves lead to the cultivation of these four great emotions. So the first thing to say about them, loving kindness, compassion, gladness, equanimity, they are unlimited in their scope. So that has immediate consequences. We can hear that and go, wow, that's great. You know, it's very uplifting that. They're unlimited in their scope. The immediate consequence of that is that therefore we don't cultivate them on our terms. We cultivate them from within our present scope, what we're capable of, but the actual practice broadens and extends that scope. And that won't happen if we insist on doing it on our terms. We've got to do it much more and much less limited than that. So we cultivate them within their terms. And their terms are unlimited. So be warned. That's not necessarily going to always be easy. That might lead us into some quite difficult and hard places. And they're described often by the Buddha, you know, after he's given other teachings, they're often, he describes them as being the outcome then of those other teachings. So I read, if you remember last night, I read a little bit from the Kalama Sutta. So that had been a teaching from the Buddha on how to know whether a particular approach, particular spiritual teaching, a spiritual path is helpful or not. And he taught them a lot about clear thinking and knowing whether something produces the good rather than the evil. And then he said, well, what I quoted last night, I'll just say it again. Finishes off, says, when a noble disciple is free from covetousness, free from ill will and undeluded, then, aware and mindful, he abides with a heart imbued with loving kindness, extending to one quarter, second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter of the world, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He abides with a heart imbued with abundant, exalted, measureless loving kindness, unhostile and unafflicted by ill will, extending to the entire world. He abides with a heart imbued with compassion in the same way, with a heart imbued with gladness. He abides with a heart imbued with equanimity. So you definitely get the sense of the unlimitedness, don't you? So, when I was first giving this talk, it was a couple of years ago. So it was 2003. And as I was writing it, actually what happened was I remembered a retreat I'd been on 2 years before that, which was in 2001. In fact, it was in September. It included September 2001. Should review, I was on it as well. And it included September the 11th, 2001. So I was on a retreat, 2 month long retreat. It was an ordination retreat. She got ordained then. And we were meditating a lot on it. Now, I was one of the people on the retreat who knew what had happened. That most people didn't. We told people at the end. But I knew all the way through. And I found myself in the position of, I mean, I don't often find myself in this position of, I was just asking myself, why am I doing this? You know, sitting meditating for, you know, several hours in the day and, you know, this kind of program, some of the programs what we've got this weekend with that amount of meditation in it. And I thought, well, why am I doing this? What good does it do? You know, who benefits? Look at what's just happened. So it brought to the fore questions about, does my meditation have a sphere of influence beyond me? How would I know if it had a sphere of influence beyond me? I might have hopes for it, or might be a bit sceptical about it. In my case, I'd be a bit more sceptical than hopeful. But, you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, how would I even know if it did? Well, of course, a meditation practice does have a sphere of concern beyond me. That's not necessarily the same as a sphere of influence, but it does have a sphere of concern beyond me. But does that actually make any difference to anyone in that sphere of concern? So I was just having these questions in my mind on this that particular occasion, and I'll come back to that later on.